Hello and welcome to the Provider Wellness Podcast. I'm Matthew Zinder, a certified registered nurse anesthetist. I'm an advanced practice nurse that specializes in the practice of anesthesia. The scope of this podcast will explore healthcare provider health and wellness from the broad to the specific. My aim is to educate while offering a unique perspective. Thank you for joining me today, and let's get right to the show. Hey folks, I hope all is well. So after almost a year, I am back on the air with a great discussion with Hallie Dresnick and Crystal Honeycutt, both of whom are certified registered nurse anesthetists and members of the American Association of Nurse Anesthesiology Health and Wellness Committee. We discuss the overall and continuing culture of poor self-care in the healthcare provider population, where we are post-COVID, and how to integrate and normalize wellness and self-care in our training programs. For more information on the resources mentioned in our discussion, please check out the show notes. So I'd like to say thanks to everyone who have asked me when I would be doing another episode, and for those who have patiently waited while I get my act together to get this show back up and running. When the responsibilities of life take over, unfortunately, volunteer activities like this podcast go to the back burner. However, moving forward, I hope to continue uploading more conversations and new information covering the health and well-being of healthcare providers. So please keep checking for new episodes. All previous episodes are available at providerwellnesspodcast.com. And remember, this show is available on all podcast platforms, so please subscribe and share the episodes. If you wish to email me with any feedback or suggestions for future shows, please do so at providerwellnesspodcast@gmail.com. So without further delay, here is my discussion with Hallie Dresnick and Crystal Honeycutt. Well, hello, Hallie and Crystal. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really do appreciate it. I just want you to know that you are helping me kick off this podcast again after being on sabbatical for almost a year. So I really do appreciate it. You are going to be the first episode to get this podcast up and running again, hopefully. So I do really appreciate your time. And I am looking forward to this conversation very much to hear about your expertise on the subject. So as I always do, if you could give me a background on yourself, and then after that, we will get into a conversation. We'll start with you, Hallie.
All right. So health and wellness has always been part of my life. My first degree was in psychology. So I just had this genuine desire to help people. And then that just wasn't the right path for me. I ended up in nursing and I love it. While I was trying to figure out what I was going to do, I taught yoga for a year or two. And that's always been part of my life. I currently serve on the AANA Health and Wellness Committee, and we have a big wellness initiative at my school that I work with. I've been a CRNA now for close to, scary to say, 15 years, and was a nurse before that in California in the ICU. So I've been really lucky at all my jobs and all the places I've worked, whether hospitals or schools, that they've incorporated health and wellness, and they've really seen the importance of it.
All right. Well, great. Thank you. Again, thank you for being here. How about you, Crystal?
Well, I started out in anesthesia and never really thought about wellness per se. I've been a CRNA about 17 years, and I graduated from Virginia Commonwealth University, and we had a small cohort. And I had an individual who was one of my classmates who ended up with a substance use disorder. And unfortunately, we lost him. He was part of the group I worked for. And looking back on it, that impacted my life greatly. After that, I started looking for ways to make this a never event. So I became a QPR instructor, which is question, persuade, refer for an individual who maybe have suicidal ideation. I've also served as a state peer advisor for Tennessee for about 5 years. I am the chair of the Tennessee Wellness Committee, and I, like Hallie, we serve together on the AANA Health and Wellness Committee. So wellness found me, not the other way around. But I, you know, I'm a program director, so I try to incorporate wellness into my students' lifestyle, into our curriculum, to try to prevent any anything from happening, to give them a safe space.
Well, great. And I really do appreciate you sharing that information. In this profession of healthcare, it's almost unfortunately like cancer. We've either dealt with it ourselves or we know someone who has had it in terms of substance use disorder, unfortunately. And I actually experienced close to the same thing. By the way, we have the same alma mater. We both went to VCU and you're both youngins because I graduated 20 years ago. My best friend in the program, 3 years after we graduated, his wife called me and told me that he was on his way to rehab. And I had no clue. I missed all the signs and symptoms because way back then I had no knowledge of any of this. Now you think back or even at that moment, if you're being told, oh, your friend's on their way to rehab, you're like, oh, wait a minute. They did start to act differently. They did start to look differently, this, that, you know. So it is so important for us to keep all of this in mind and know the signs and symptoms of our colleagues and hopefully give them the support that they need. If we do start to see any changes in their behavior or their actions or any of the above. And that's why I personally have a lot of interest in what we're doing. And also am a member of the AANA Health and Wellness Committee. For the listeners who are not in anesthesia, that is the American Association of Nurse Anesthesiology, our national association. So as we get into this topic of conversation, because again, this is obviously a source of great interest of mine. How did you, the two of you, get into it as far as, and I know that you said, Crystal, that it kind of found you. But as you go further into your careers, how are you navigating the difference? And I found because we have this culture problem where we're taught to only take care of others and not ourselves. When it comes to that culture problem, how do you navigate that? Along with this interest in wanting to help your own, you know, your fellow healthcare providers. Crystal, you want to start with that?
Sure. It can be difficult because culture is, as we know, is something slow to change. And we make a big joke out of it, at least we do at the facilities I work at. We say CRNAs are not warm-friendly people. Right. Generally, we're to the point. We have to make quick decisions. We have to sometimes, not necessarily for those who are not in the OR, hurt feelings, but we have to say what we mean and advocate for our patient. So sometimes we tend to suppress, you know, our, not necessarily our feelings, but maybe what we show to others. And I think the way we change the culture, the way I'm trying to present it, is to have these conversations, to have open dialogue, and sometimes just simply asking somebody, you know, kind of how they're doing, you know, how are you, and truly mean it, you know, how are you feeling? Because, you know, if we just, you know, start explaining and talking about articles and research, people shut us down. But if we bring it back kind of to the personal level, and let it, you know, we're all human. And I think sometimes we forget that CRNAs are, you know, that we're, you know, we're not, you know, impenetrable, that bad things can happen, that we have feelings. And because I'm a program director, I, you know, have to remind everyone that, you know, our students are going in through a lot of stress and we need to meet them kind of where they are. So I don't really know if I answered your question more or less, just the way I feel. I feel like if we just kind of bring it up in conversation, kind of walk the walk, you know, and talk, you know, talk to people, you know, and be sincere. That's kind of the way I try to involve, like, on the everyday interaction.
Yeah, that's great. How about you, Hallie? I mean, how do you deal with that, that culture of kind of being taught not to take care of ourselves?
Yeah, I think, you know, what Crystal brings up is a really good point. There's so many times where someone will say good morning and I'll say, hi, how are you? And when I actually pause to give them time to respond, they're like, oh, I get to answer, mm-hmm. you know, it's not just mm-hmm. like, oh, okay, keep going. For me, you know, I think it's about just taking a moment, even if it is 30 seconds a day, and being like, this 30 seconds is for myself. You know, and being a little selfish with our time when we do have that free time, that we do something good for ourselves. We advocate for patients, we advocate for our students, but you know, we often take the back burner. So I think, you know, before you get to that point of needing to talk to someone, even there's just these little things we can do, and they're different for everybody, that will help you to incorporate wellness into your life so that you don't get to that overwhelmed point. Or if you do, then you have these resources to go back to.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I'm constantly talking about this subject either on the lecture circuit or in all these different avenues where I'm trying to either research or kind of get the word out or try to have this overreaching goal of changing the culture. And I've kind of come to believe that there is a short-term, mid-term, and long-term solution to the fact that we're all kind of in trouble right now as far as healthcare and healthcare providers. And the short-term solution is we take matters into our own hands and we practice what we know to be healthy activities, as you said, Holly. And the midterm solution is we change curriculum and we normalize these behaviors. And the long-term solution, and this is the very long-term solution, and that is we change policy and we make it an expectation in terms of licensure, just like they do in aviation. You're not a professional pilot unless you are healthy. It's the bottom line. So why not do that in healthcare? And we may turn things around a bit. So in terms of that, when it comes to integrating these types of initiatives or thought processes or even changing, you know, the way that we're taught, how does that happen? Crystal, being a program director, this is obviously probably difficult when you're dealing with people who are already healthcare providers of different experiences. They're all ICU nurses, but some have been for 3 years and some have been for 10 or 15, right? So mm-hmm. they're still ingrained in that culture. So how does a person in your position address that?
Well, it's a work in progress. I would love to say that everything's perfect, but anesthesia school, no matter where you go, is stress. And it's a lot of material, short amount of time, and they're invested in so many ways. They've quit jobs that they loved. They've maybe moved across the country. So, you know, we can't take that away, but we can tell them it's normal to feel stressed. It's normal to have emotions. And I try to reiterate that when you're having a difficulty with a concept, maybe it's a clinical skill. Maybe you feel like you're not learning to intubate and everybody else has mastered the skill. I remind them that we only see our point. You know, there is a thing called imposter syndrome. And I tell the student, it can be normal to be sitting in that classroom and look around and feel like everybody else here knows exactly what they're doing. Everybody else is meant to be here. And for some reason, you're not. So I try to tell them that this is a thing, but it's not a true statement. And that everybody has a weakness. And that's okay. We're human. I encourage them to, we bring in our counseling center every semester. And so that the students become familiar with our mental health counselors, you know, on a first name basis, so that when they are stressed or before they become, you know, as Hallie mentioned, before you get to that point of being overwhelmed, they would be more likely to pick up a phone and call someone they know, or maybe somebody they've seen before, to kind of normalize that you go to the doctor for a checkup for your, you know, medical problems, for your physical health. It's okay to go to someone for your mental well-being as well. It's okay to talk to somebody. And sometimes that's what we need. So, you know, it's not a 100%, you know, we, like I said, we're nurses, we're ICU nurses, we're advanced, you know, some of our students are advanced practice nurses. We have acute care nurse practitioners and family nurse practitioners that come back. So it can be hard to change that what's ingrained into them. But we try to do that. We try to, promote healthier activities. I think that even for myself, I fall short. You know, I try to take time, but sometimes I find myself like I know the both of you are very busy too. And that sometimes we're working when maybe we should be relaxing, or when we're relaxing, we're thinking about work. So it's not a perfect science. It's we're making positive steps. And I feel like, you know, although we don't have, you know, any statistical data to back this, the students feel more comfortable and they are more likely to voice, they're going to take a break, or they're more likely to tell us if there's an issue.
Well, that's great. I mean, the fact that you're normalizing it, I love the fact that you bring in the counseling services and normalize that, because I talk about this in my lectures at the conferences all the time. I just don't understand the stigma that is attached to psychological assistance. I mean, if you fall over and break your arm, are you going to stand up and say, oh, I'm just going to suck this up? No, you're going to go to an orthopedic surgeon and have the arm set. It'll heal normally. You'll go about your life. So why is it that there is a stigma attached to evidence-based definitive treatment related to your most important organ? It's a shame, because it is that effective. So I love the fact that you normalize that with your students. That's really great, because that's so incredibly helpful. Now, Hallie, are you, because I don't think you'd mentioned like your work life, are you also in academia?
Yeah, so I'm the program director for a doctorate completion program and a nurse educator track. And so I'm still also in clinical practice. So there's a lot to like Crystal, we're balanced, do our best to balance it all.
Right. So now, as far as the requirements for academia or the academic programs, I know the COA, Council on Accreditation, puts out requirements that there be some aspect of wellness in your curriculum. But as I understand it, it's pretty vague. Is it still that way? And how does your average program or your program address it to fulfill those requirements, Hallie?
So I will say I've been really impressed at our conferences, at AD, the Assembly of Didactic Educators and AANA, how many people have come up to me that they are incorporating health and wellness into their curriculum. What we're doing at my school is following the eight dimensions of wellness and just finding ways that we can incorporate those with the students. We've turned our evaluations on student services and different technology projects and kind of categorized it with the eight dimensions of wellness to see how we're doing. So the school's in Tennessee. So one thing is like a tornado came and one person happened to be on campus studying, school was closed, and they didn't know the safest place to go. So all things like that, that's your environmental wellness, you know, if you know where to go. So we're trying to really put together a comprehensive wellness toolkit of all those dimensions and just find ways that aren't so in your face to incorporate them. We have not as big of a school, but we have a relationship with a counseling center outside of the school that we can refer people to. We are trying to do, you know, stand up and move in the classroom. We have an academic coach there for people that just need a little help with test taking tips, you know, offering earplugs for those get distracted. You just simple little things, but trying to hit each of those dimensions of wellness. And I think you brought up a really good point with the stigma, because, you know, people will say, like, especially all of us that were CRNAs and in a big biology class or something like that, undergraduate, you know, if you were at a big school, you were one of 200 sitting in a lecture hall and you went to class and you left and the teacher probably didn't even know your name. So when did it start, you know, that we need to care? And I think the students are telling us that we need to care. And that's where curriculum change comes from. And the policy needs to respond to what we're seeing in our students.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the thing. I mean, we're dealing now with, you know, the fallout of our buddy COVID. And interestingly enough, while we are in the thick of it, because I've been in the wellness realm, I mean, I've been on the lecture circuit for about 13 years. The business of anesthesia is what started my speaking career. But about 6 or 7 years ago, I started to look into wellness myself, healthcare provider wellness. And a lot of people ask me why I got into it. And the answer was self-preservation, because I was getting sick from the level of stress that I was under at the time. And so I started to look into it. I was already a speaker at the time. So I integrated that into new talks and interest and research and all of the above. And I had to really sell that content to conferences. No one was interested. Not to say that I'm any Tony Robbins or anything, but I really had to sell it. They wanted the business content. They wanted the clinical content. But then when COVID came along, everybody gave me a call, which was great for the career. But then, it was also good because, okay, I'm thinking, well, great. Finally, we're recognizing the need. And on top of that, it just put us into an even worse position, because not only were we already stressed out before this all started, then we started circling the drain because we were unprepared for the situation. So wellness became popular. But now I'm finding that the culture has snapped firmly back into place now that we're, quote, post-COVID. And I'm having to sell the content again. And the problem there is we're still dealing with the fallout of the experience, where I'm sure the two of you have seen, and I've seen in the programs that I've been a part of as adjunct, is that you're now dealing with an entire cohort that is still dealing with issues related to being COVID ICU nurses. Whereas some programs out there can give a person PTSD from being in the program, now you've got students starting your program with PTSD because they were COVID ICU nurses again. So when it comes to that, I am starting to see a little bit more recognition from programs and the need for taking care of students, in that, you know, we have to take care of them because they're coming in struggling. Which is a great thing. And I'm, you know, and we're all three on the AANA Health and Wellness Committee. Can you, Crystal, speak a little bit to how AANA is addressing, you know, all of the above?
Oh, yeah, the AANA does a wonderful job. There are a lot of resources, as we know, on the website. I refer to our website like I own it personally, but on the website, and a lot of information, a lot of links for help. There's a lot of information, such as the suicide hotline, things of that nature, to kind of, you know, help an individual. Also, there's a transition in the way we're going to be looking at different things. But currently, we have state peer advisors for each state whose phone numbers are available in the event someone has a substance use disorder, or maybe somebody's doing reentry into practice, and that where we're available, we're confidential. And I know for Tennessee, we go to the different schools. We try to talk, at least know the program directors at each school, to make that available. And that's part of the initiative. Although it's from TANA, it's related to the whole state peer advisor network in the AANA. So that's just some of the resources that are available. And I know that at different meetings, they provide wellness-related topics, which are phenomenal. Just that kind of support as well. I know that in the past, I'm a QPR instructor. And for those of you who know what that is, and for those of you don't, it stands for question, persuade, and refer. And it's a hour-long kind of a presentation, interactive class where individuals are taught about suicidal ideation, what to do if you suspect someone is, how do we question somebody appropriately, how do we get the courage to question somebody, how do we persuade them to accept help, and then where do we send them once they've acknowledged they need help. And the AANA had me come and, provide those services. And I've had different, just from that interaction at the, I think it was the annual Congress that I presented at, I have had connections across the country where I have went to speak to different individuals, different schools, different teams, so that we can just, I know wellness, when I talk about wellness and I bring up suicidal ideation, it's not the pretty topic. It's not a topic that a lot of people want to talk about, but it is a topic. And unfortunately, it's a topic, particularly in our field, that's necessary. So I know that's kind of digressed from the AANA resources, but it ties in the fact that they do, at least in the past, we have provided those services and have it available throughout.
Well, it's so important. I mean, the three main ones, I mean, I actually do a talk on PTSD and healthcare providers. That's, you know, and then, of course, our friend Rodrigo Garcia is the the guru of substance use disorder and healthcare providers, which I think he'll be on the podcast again here pretty soon to talk about that subject. But those are the three main ones that we have to talk about, and we have to recognize what the symptoms are of all three. Hallie, did you say that you also take part in the QPR training?
I'm actually going through it right now.
Oh, okay. And
Crystal and I have talked about this a lot too. It's, you know, every school should have a list of resources, and not every person is, even if you've done the QPR training, maybe you can recognize the symptoms, but you're not comfortable beyond that, you know? So, we highly recommend having just a list available of resources for every kind of wellness problem, domestic violence, suicide, drug abuse, divorce attorney resource. I mean, it can just go on and on and on and be endless. And, you know, if you're not comfortable, grab somebody with you that is. And as healthcare providers, we always want to treat, right? Like, that's in our mind. But as educators and coworkers, we're not there to treat, you know? We can provide the resources and get them to the right person. And I think if everyone can remember that, we could just help so much more, as opposed to trying to take things, you know, on our own. We've all had our friend that's, been involved in substance abuse, I think, in this profession. And I realized, you know, I knew what was going on, and I almost became an enabler because I was trying to help her myself, and I didn't know how, you know, and the guilt I felt, you know, from doing that I finally just, you know, screamed at her one day, we need to get you help, you know. But I had just kind of tried to support and say, why don't you try this? But I didn't have the tools. I didn't know what I was doing. And most of us don't. So, you know, provide the resources, but get them to the right person, I think, is really what we can do a better job at. Sorry.
I was just going to kind of say that's absolutely it, is that I think as CRNAs as a whole, we're so used to trying to find the answer, to try to help everybody, that it's, we kind of sometimes step out of our scope. And so I try to remind people when I do any, you know, presentations, some of my colleagues are CRNAs and psych mental health nurse practitioners, and that's phenomenal. I'm not. So I try, I'm like you, I want to say, you know, I'm here if you just need to talk, but if we need, you know, if you need help, or I perceive you need help, or you perceive you need help, we need to, you know, kind of walk hand in hand, maybe. And I make a big joke out of it. I have a colleague who she'll tell you she is not the person to come to with any mental. It's not she doesn't care. She probably has a bigger heart than most people I know. But some of the things she says are just really blunt and blatant. And so when you said, if you're not the person, she always says, I'm not the person, because, you know, somebody who does not have suicidal ideation, maybe after they speak with her, not to be ugly, but she just, you know, will say things but, you know, like I said, she's probably got a bigger heart than mine. It's just, she has a complete, you know, she's just blunt to the point. And if she doesn't understand why you're feeling a certain way, she'll say, well, that doesn't make any sense to me. So,
right.
But I agree with you, Hallie. We need to seek help when, you know, when someone needs it.
I love how you said, you know, I'll take your hand and walk you there. And I kind of, you know, it became that person at my last clinical practice job. It only happened twice, you know, in 12 years, but it's twice in 12 years is a lot, where my boss, you know, called and said, I think you should come here and talk to so-and-so. And one was the girl that I had felt like I'd been enabling, and one was just a complete surprise, you know, that I got there and she seems a little bit out of it. And both of them, you know, we just walked over to the ER and got them, you know, where they needed to go. But I think that that's just as important when you don't know what to do, to just be supportive, you know, walk shoulder to shoulder and get them where they need to go.
Yeah, I mean, because again, we're healthcare providers. So the urge is to treat, the urge is to fix. And in Western medicine trained healthcare, it's about treatment after the fact. Whereas I think a lot of us also, when we're looking at health and wellness and well-being and all that sort of research, we can shift our focus a little bit to prevention, which is not part of our Western medicine training. And if we can prevent by having some of these initiatives and normalizing these activities that we all look at, like things like, I don't know, like, you know, breathing exercises and journaling and meditation and all these things, exercise and eating right, all the, you know, some of the cliche things that we know to be necessary for good health, then some of us may not go down that other road where we need treatment. But if we do, then, as you said, we should know where the resources are and know our limitations as well, which is very important. I'm always talking about the AANA helpline. All healthcare providers have an association. If you're licensed and accredited, you all have an association. And I am very confident that that national association has a helpline. I know the physicians do, and we certainly do. And we have a robust one. And by the way, Rigo Garcia is the one who answers that phone if you call. So it's an incredible resource that anyone can call for any reason. And it doesn't have to be the person who's struggling. You may want advice on how to help a person who is struggling to get them those right resources. So from that, you know, side, either one of you can comment on this. What, and this is for the listeners, what signs and symptoms might someone exhibit in any of the above topics that we've just mentioned that may be a cause for concern where you may want to help them find those resources?
Well, I think me and Hallie were talking about this the other day. It was, you know, we had a phone call, and so we'll probably bounce back and forth between each other. But any major change, I think that's what we distinguish as one of the key features, is any major change. So it may be your friend who's normally outgoing and now they're withdrawn. It may be the student who is always at the university at 8 a.m. and now at 8:15 they're dragging in. They may have been the person who's always organized, now they're not, or you know, somebody who was not interested in religion, now that's all they talk about, or somebody who was very religious or very spiritual, and now they have gave that away. So to me, the one of the key factors, and one of the things that, you know, I wish people knew, were any major change in someone, you know, and I think we get scared that if we bring something to light, that somebody's going to get mad. Well, they might, but at least they're alive to be mad at us. But I think if you talk to somebody with the right kind of heart or the right kind of, you know, desire to help, that they won't. And sometimes it's a relief if you just ask somebody, are you okay? Here's what I've noticed, you know, do you need anything, or is there anything I can help you, or do, you know, we need to go somewhere and talk with somebody. So I'll kind of put the ball back in your court, Hallie.
No, I think, you know, just a real life example that I had with that at work was a friend, you know, my friend, she always, even with her scrub cap, you know, came with a beautiful face of makeup and mascara on. And, you know, everyone would say, oh, so-and-so is always so, you know, done up for work. And oh, you know, that's just how she is. And then she started to not wear any makeup. And that was when I finally addressed her. And I said, you know, there's just such this change where not only was she not wearing makeup, but her scrubs were more wrinkled and just this change in her appearance. And she answered me by saying, well, when I wore makeup, everyone said, why do you wear so much makeup? And, you know, it was a good point, but I said, no, but it's a change, you know, it's a major change from how you are. And I think we need to notice those things. And in students, you know, we can notice those things as educators. If someone's always walking with certain people to lunch or chatty in the morning before class, and then they're just withdrawn, or they start to get up a lot and use the restroom, or start not to test so well when they've been doing well. Just these little things, if they're tired and they're normally okay, but they're putting their head down or not paying attention or not participating, just any change, like Crystal said, we need to just take the time to say, are you okay? And wait and really listen and hear the answer.
And I've heard that a few times in other lectures that I have seen, where it is huge to truly just ask with sincerity, how are you? Are you okay? And listen, as opposed to, hey, how you doing? I'm fine. How are you? Good. As you're, you know, and that's the end of it, the cliche. But if you truly show that you have interest and or concern and are there to listen, then you may get a little bit more. And that might be what that person needs. And then, of course, be aware of the resources that are available for any of the above topics we've just mentioned. And the overreaching, very general one is the helpline, because those resources exist as far as that's concerned. I think that could really go a long way, that's for sure. But, you know, in terms of academia, back to that, as far as, you know, what the students are currently going through, have you seen kind of what I described in your programs, where you've got students coming in already a bit, you know, a bit on the struggling side, and then all of the intensity of the program is placed upon them, because these anesthesia training programs are incredibly intense, just like we experienced. And then, you know, what kind of outcomes are you seeing? And then how does one, you know, address that, whether it be prevention or treatment, as far as what kind of interventions do you recommend to them and really expect of them? As part of, because my whole thing is, I think that when I say it should become part of curriculum, it should be as important as, all right, now you have to understand what MAC is and how to operate an anesthesia machine and how to intubate. And you also have to understand and practice these healthy exercises so you're a healthy practitioner for your patients. So, you know, what kind of things are you seeing, and then how does your program address it? And I know we kind of addressed, you know, the COA requirements, but when it comes to current state of affairs, is there anything specific that you're recommending or actually requiring of your students, Crystal?
Well, I've noticed that, and I don't have, again, statistical data to back this up, but I've noticed over the last, I'd say 3 to 4 years, students seem to have a higher degree of stress upon entering the program. Like I said, it's an expectation after you're in a program. But I've noticed early on there has been there seems to be a higher degree of although I don't ask for it, sometimes students will tell you of, you know, pre-diagnosis of anxiety, depression. And, you know, again, unfortunately, sometimes people see that and think that that's a negative. To me, untreated could be a potential negative, you know, for the patient, for the individual themselves. But treatment, that's what you want. You want people who are able, you know, who are taking care of their mental health as well. And like I said, that's part of the culture in healthcare, I think, trying to destigmatize someone who may have anxiety or may have depression. But, you know, what we encourage, and although it's not mandated, we do encourage, you know, speaking with Eric, because we have a robust counseling center here. So we encourage that they can meet online, they can do Zoom meetings. They can even meet when they're out of state at different clinical sites, so they can schedule with their counselor and be able to speak with them. And I remind them it's completely confidential. It's, you know, HIPAA violation if I would ask, and I would not ask. I don't want them to feel like they can't seek out those services. So we encourage that. The things we do mandate during their first year in our program, we do the QPR training with them, because students, I think, as educators, we know that sometimes students may not approach us for fear of how we would perceive them, or fear that, you know, sometimes they have an unhealthy fear that, oh, you'll kick me out of the program, when that's the furthest thing from the truth. So I do QPR training with them, and I make them promise that if they would not confide in me, or if they felt, you know, like harming themselves or anything down those lines, that they would seek out each other, that you're all in the same boat. And so we do the QPR training so they can each serve as a gatekeeper for their, you know, for their colleagues, for their cohort. So we do mandate that. We mandate that they, attend the lectures that the counselors provide, you know, during the semester. And then they attend a state meeting their first year. And I do require that any wellness lectures that are being presented, that they are, you know, in attendance, just so that they can hear it from somebody other than me. And then one of my friends, who is also a Tennessee State peer advisor, he comes in and does our substance use disorder lecture, because, again, I feel like if anyone was wanting to talk or be open, they're more likely to approach him as opposed to me. So that's, you know, kind of just how we're, you know, dealing with it initially. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of work to be done, as we said, throughout long-term goals. But this has been our initial reaction.
Oh, no, that's great. That's great. And so let's say a potential student or someone who's been accepted and is about to enter a program, let's say your program, and approaches you, Hallie, and says, you know what, I'm about to start your program. I hear that anesthesia training programs are incredibly intense and very, very difficult. And I'm already kind of dealing with stress and anxiety from my experience as a COVID ICU nurse. What kind of initiatives might you, or what kind of resources might you have, and or what kind of recommendations might you have for me as someone coming into your program?
Sure. I'd ask you if you wanted me to call the counseling center with you and just set up something. I've done that many times with the students in my office that just come to me stressed, or if the student came to me new, I'd say, is this something you're interested in? You know, I usually don't ask them if they have someone outside. If they want to offer that information, that's fine. But I, at my last school, was a state school, and, you know, that was very inexpensive for them to go over to the counseling center or student health and use those services. We also have an academic coach, but that is a great resource at our school. She just helps with study tips and getting organized and time management. And a lot of that stuff that's really stressful to students, especially students returning to school that haven't been there in a while. I try to set them up. You know, I tell them, form a WhatsApp group. You don't have to include me. You know, make friends. Make yourself accountable. You know, I think that's one of the biggest things. I got that advice as a student way back when in college, and it changed my whole student experience. I had a professor say, make yourself accountable. Even if you don't have a question, come by my office so I know who you are. And I did. I went by and I asked some silly question. And I think even when I'm teaching online and I say, I can't make you turn on your camera, but I think you'll do better if I see your face and you're accountable. And I think the same thing, you know, tell the students to stop by, make sure everyone knows who they are. That way we can check in. I think when you're a student that's having issues and you're just not telling anyone, we'll never know. So make sure all the faculty and the staff and everyone there knows who you are. And that way, if you're having a bad day, we see it. If you have one of those big changes, we see it. So I think that's probably some of the best advice I could give to a student coming in, besides all the resources that they can find. I was in a health and wellness committee meeting for the school the other day, and one of the student representatives said she read our website and there is a lot of information on them, start to finish, to see if this was a culture that she would fit in well with, like what the resources were and how it would affect her emotional wellness and her cultural wellness and if it fit in with who she was as a person. So I would say that too, you know, especially if you're deciding between a few schools, see if they celebrate the same things that are important to you, because that will add to your happiness and your well-being, and just see if the culture fits with what you're looking for. When I only got as far as orientation for my master's in psychology, but they were going to require like 20 counseling sessions, you know, for you to do that program. And my first job as a nurse, that was one of our benefits. And that was way, you know, way back, was a certain amount of sessions with a counselor. And I remember being in orientation with another nurse next to me said, "Oh, well, I'm going to use all those." And I thought, really? But yeah, we need them. Right. So I think having those resources, if your school doesn't have them, just push for them. We need to make a change. And, you know, it needs to be substantial. It just can't be a couple little things here and there. We need to be demanding these things in our profession, even as CRNAs, like the benefits our job offers us. Do they contribute to our health and wellness besides just financial well-being?
All great points. I love that the both of you encourage counseling so much in your programs, because that normalizes it. And that's very, very important, especially today with those of us who are struggling. Because, again, it is definitive. It is evidence based, and it can really bring someone to the other side and help them be more effective as providers. You know, we have very quickly come to an hour, believe it or not. And I really want to thank the both of you for giving of your time to be on the program. And I did not warn either one of you of this ahead of time, so I hate to put you on the spot, but I always allow my guests to give a final thought. So if you wish to, please do so. So, Crystal?
Well, I think my final thought would be, particularly for anybody in education, even if it's clinical preceptor, is to see your student as a person. I know that sounds crazy, you know, that we wouldn't, but to see them as a person that, you know, if they're not performing perfect that day, maybe there's a reason, to try to normalize that interaction. And I liked what Hallie said about, you know, kind of, you know, being accountable for knowing somebody. And I think it go both ways, that as faculty, we should be held accountable for not being friends with our students per se. We can't be that close. We have to, you know, have a distance, but to get to know them and see them as individuals, so that, you know, that means a lot, you know. You know, using somebody's name, letting them know you know who they are, and maybe remembering a little piece of information about them, that's very important. So I think just don't forget the humanity when we're dealing with students and our colleagues.
All right. Well, thank you. And Hallie?
I think, you know, teaching the students the skills now, whether it's deep breathing that works for them or prayer or exercising, whatever, seeing a counselor, our profession, right? Our students have high risk of suicide, high drug abuse, but so does our profession. So I think we really need to get serious about ingraining this in our curriculum. So when these people graduate, they have the skills as CRNAs to deal with what we deal with on a daily basis. And I think it's just got to change and start now, or they'll never, you know, once you're out there and practicing, life is busy and it's hard to then start incorporating those things. Also, I just think all these wonderful things we want to do for our students, we have to remember to do for ourselves. and sometimes that's the easiest thing to forget.
100%. I couldn't have said it any better myself. And I'm always reminding healthcare providers that if you take care of yourself first, you're actually going to be a better provider and more effective provider for your patients. So in conclusion, I really do appreciate, again, the both of you being on the podcast. And I hope to work with you continually into the future. I really do appreciate it. Hopefully you can have more conversations like this. For the listeners, I will be putting as many resources as I can come up with into the show notes, especially the helpline. I'll put both the AANA helpline and a physician helpline on there, and do not hesitate to call that. I'll also put the QPR website on there as well, amongst other resources. So again, thank you both very, very much for being on the program. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So that'll do it for this episode. I hope to see you at the next one. This is Matthew Zinder and the Provider Wellness Podcast. Please stay safe and stay well.